The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
It's the new year, which means a fresh start for your business. And a great year starts with making great hires. But posting your job in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. If you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post your jobs on all the top job sites. And now you can. With ZipRecruiter, you can jumpstart your hiring in 2017. Post your jobs to 200-plus job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. Just post once and watch your qualified candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by over 1 million businesses. And right now, my listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. That's ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. One more time to try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/free trial.
This is the CBS News Year-End Roundup, the second half, nearly an hour more of information and analysis looking at the big events of 2016. I'm Dan Raviv at CBS News in Washington. There was nothing bigger than the presidential election here in the United States.
I love you. Thank you.
Donald Trump was unbeatable in almost all the Republican primaries and in the debates.
Matter of principle, and I'll tell you.
The single biggest liar, probably, or worse than.
No need to be polite. He said Muslims, then changed it to people from countries with terrorism, would not be allowed into the U.S. He denied unwanted sexual advances toward women. He disparaged the media, telling one reporter,
"You're a sleaze."
Mr. Trump said he had the most loyal supporters.
I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody, and I wouldn't lose any voters, okay?
What counted for Donald Trump was victory.
We're going to start winning again. We're going to win so much, you may even get tired of winning.
He won the Republican nomination for the White House and broke convention at the Republican convention in Cleveland by appearing every night.
Thank you, and may God bless.
Hillary Clinton led a divided Democratic Party because in the primaries, Senator Bernie Sanders won 43% of the votes, but he did endorse her at the convention in Philadelphia.
Hillary Clinton will make an outstanding president, and I am proud to stand with her.
Sanders left the stage. Clinton now had Donald Trump attacking her full time. She debated him three times. He gazed at her and called her crooked.
I am going to instruct my attorney general to get a special prosecutor.
At his rallies, the 70-year-old Mr. Trump mocked Secretary Clinton, who turned 69 during the campaign, as lacking stamina.
She has less energy than Jeb Bush.
Trump repeated allegations. He quoted from hacked emails released by WikiLeaks, said she illegally had secrets on her server. Clinton did not get the upsurge many thought would happen of women thrilled there could be the first female president. She spoke of equality.
If that's playing the woman's card, then deal me in.
Her rallies were smaller and less exciting than Trump's.
Bye. Go home to mommy.
Even watching hecklers ejected made him look strong.
Tell her to tuck you in bed.
As Election Day approached, almost all pundits said, as Mr. Trump put it,
there is no path to 270.
The number of electoral votes needed to become president, but
it was an amazing evening. We ended up with 306, which was a landslide.
Of the 13 battleground states, he won 9. Clinton supporters sadly pointed to the popular votes. She got 48%, Mr. Trump 46%. Hillary Clinton had 2.8 million more votes, but he is the winner, naming his cabinet and huge ambitions.
We're going to undertake one of the great tax reforms and simplify.
Promising lower taxes, especially for corporations.
And we will make America great again.
All around the world, questions remain. What does Mr. Trump really believe, and what will he do?
We're joined by CBS News contributor, longtime Face the Nation anchor Bob Schieffer. You were part of our coverage all this year at CBS News. Let's start with this, Donald Trump's victory, especially thinking of November 8th, Election Day, Election Night. Was it a surprise?
Yes. I don't know a single person, and I don't know anybody who thought that this was going to happen. I was one of those early on that thought he was going to get the Republican nomination because I thought I understood just how upset and mad people were. But I always felt that as we finally got into the general election, that would change, that the solutions he was proposing I didn't think were realistic, and I thought more people would see that. But in the end, he won. People were even madder than I thought they were. Somehow, Trump heard and figured out when other politicians didn't, including Hillary Clinton.
Even if he didn't have the precise solution, are you saying that, should we call them the working class, the people in middle America, at least felt that he's on their side?
This was an election where attitude counted more than facts and issues. People admired Donald Trump because they said he wasn't afraid to speak his mind. I heard that in rallies I would go to where he was speaking. We made the mistake of taking him literally. I think those who were his core supporters didn't really take him literally, but they took him seriously.
What was Hillary Clinton's problem? Again and again, I heard after the election, often from Democrats, she was a bad candidate.
She never found a way to connect with the people that she needed most, and that was middle-class working Americans. I think her campaign lacked a very important ingredient, excitement. Rightly or wrongly, I think many voters felt that she thought she was entitled to win.
And Bob, if many voters thought that a Hillary Clinton presidency would just be a third term of Obama, and they'd been disappointed or felt disappointed by the past 8 years, that might have been a reasonable expectation. She and her team would have been more Obama-style.
You know, I think Barbara Bush may have hit on something very early when Jeb Bush was thinking about running, and she said, "Are there no other families in America besides the Bushes and the Clintons? I'm afraid people are tired of the Bushes and the Clintons." She may have been on to something.
What do you expect from the Trump presidency? During the campaign, he was a disruptor. He didn't care about being politically correct. He would say almost anything. He's continued as president-elect to tweet and say almost anything. But as president?
The one thing I learned during this campaign is don't try to predict Donald Trump, nor should one try to predict what the reaction will be to what he says. Because as we saw when he said John McCain was a loser, when he made fun of the handicapped reporter for the New York Times, when he said what he said about Megyn Kelly, I thought all of those things would be disqualifiers for any candidate for any office in American politics, and yet they seem to roll off his back. We used to talk about Ronald Reagan being the Teflon president. This brought new meaning to the word Teflon. I think the country is still as divided as it was throughout this campaign, but how Trump goes about healing that divide, or whether he even tries to heal the divide. He says he wants to.
He might not be interested in the same things liberals usually talk about, civil rights, gay rights. So he says all he cares about is jobs and prosperity. That's his goal. So with a Republican-controlled Congress, he might achieve something.
Oh, I think he probably will. Now, how far that goes, whether these are realistic solutions, whether he can actually get more people back to work in those rural areas in the middle of the country, we'll have to see. And let me also say, Dan, I wish him well. I hope he does succeed. I think all Americans hope that because we want the country to succeed. But right now, I have no predictions on how this is going to go.
One of our great veteran correspondents here at CBS News, Bob Schieffer. Please stay with us a lot more as we look at the year 2016, including the new Congress. Will it cut our taxes? On the CBS News Year-End Roundup. On the CBS News Year-End Roundup, I'm Dan Revive. What was 2016 like for business and the economy? In the eighth year of a liberal in the White House, before the change to a billionaire businessman hiring conservative Republicans, CBS's Frank Settapani reports.
It was the year of the CEO smackdown on Capitol Hill.
You should resign. You should give back the money that you took while this scam was going on.
Wells Fargo's top man got an earful for letting the bank cheat customers on his watch. Mylan's CEO took heat for jacking up the price of the life-saving EpiPen.
You put it out of reach of the average consumer.
Corporations were roasted for going overseas to duck taxes.
A lot of it's legal, but that's exactly the problem.
When oil plunged to a 12-year low in January, the stock market tumbled.
There's just too much oil.
In time, oil and stocks recovered. Unemployment went down.
More employers are putting out the help wanted sign.
But more jobs went overseas.
The working class man is going to be in extinction.
Free trade got the blame.
NAFTA was the worst trade deal in the history of this country.
The economy grew, but not enough to give Americans everything they wanted.
Equal pay for equal work. Paid leave. Raising the minimum wage.
Frank Settapani, CBS News.
For investors in stocks, there was a Trump rally in the 6 weeks after Election Day. The Dow Jones average rose by 9%. Now, when we talk about election 2016, let's not forget a big part was not the presidency, but the new Congress. We turn to CBS News correspondent Stephen Portnoy. For many months, Democrats said they were optimistic about recapturing control of the Senate. Some Democrats thought they had a chance to capture the House of Representatives. Of course, they assumed Donald Trump would lose the race for the White House. How did all that turn out?
Not as well as Democrats had hoped. Even in the last days, they were hoping they could do well. But in the end, they picked up just 7 seats in the House. They did whittle away at what was a pretty sizable historic GOP majority in the 114th Congress. In the 115th Congress, Republicans will still have a 47-seat majority in the House. In the Senate, Democrats picked up a net gain of 2 seats. But starting January 3rd, the GOP will have 52 seats. And that's important because it's enough if all the Republicans stick together to confirm any of President Trump's nominees for the executive and judicial branches.
What should we look for in the coming weeks when it comes to confirmation hearings?
I would look for fights on key posts. Attorney General Jeff Sessions, the senator from Alabama, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos, Housing and Urban Development Secretary Designate Ben Carson, the Ambassador to Israel David Friedman, among others, not to mention Mr. Trump's eventual choice of a justice to replace Antonin Scalia. Epic fights ahead. And on the Supreme Court, that does still allow for a 60-vote filibuster margin. Democrats could still theoretically block a Trump appointment to the high court.
What are the top priorities? Because I've heard, I guess every 4 years we hear this, and with the House, we hear it kind of every 2 years, the plan for the first 100 days of the Congress. Something ambitious?
And there are 2 key priorities for this Republican Congress and this Republican president: to repeal Obamacare and reform the tax code. Republicans in Congress are preparing to use the special reconciliation process that does not allow for a Democratic Senate filibuster. But under that process, Republicans will be limited in just how much they can, for example, when it comes to Obamacare repeal, actually change the health insurance markets. They might need to get some Democrats on board and overcome a 60-vote filibuster threshold in the Senate if they really want to change things much more than a straight repeal of, for example, the portion of the Affordable Care Act that helps sustain the exchanges. So Republicans can, with a simple 51-vote margin in the Senate, no longer fund those exchanges. But when it comes to a replacement plan, that's going to be a much higher mountain for Republicans to climb. And one challenge for Republicans coming up in the first 100 days of this presidency, the debt ceiling. Remember that? It was waived in late 2015 as part of a 2-year budget agreement reached between President Obama and John Boehner, the former House Speaker. Well, the debt ceiling will come back into effect on March 15th of 2017. Could be a pretty intense fight in Congress.
And that may be relevant because President-elect Trump has indicated that he wants to cut taxes but boost spending on infrastructure. That would mean a bigger deficit, though some Republicans say they will find cuts elsewhere. Tell me something about the tax plan. Our listeners will want to know. Just about everyone will have lower income taxes in the coming year?
Not necessarily, and not if you are an upper middle class family. There are going to be some people currently taxed at the 28% bracket that, experts say, could wind up seeing their taxes go up to 33%. And that's why it is somewhat controversial. President-elect Trump has talked about lowering taxes on the middle class, and he would do that. But when it comes to people on the upper end of the middle class, people who are not exactly, you know, millionaires, but people who have a pretty significant income and do fairly well, upwards of, let's say, $250,000 a year, those people could wind up actually seeing a tax increase while almost everyone else gets a tax cut. So the details are not firmly worked out yet. The Republicans in the House have a plan, and President-elect Trump has a plan. Somewhere in the middle they'll meet, but there certainly is a serious appetite for tax reform in this 115th Congress.
The GOP majority is excited about reducing corporate taxes. They say the 35% rate income tax on corporations is probably the highest in the world. They want to get it down so that money will flow back to the U.S. They say companies will hire people. It's a big part of the Republican plan.
A huge part of the Republican plan. You hear President-elect Trump talk about it at every single one of his rallies. He says that the United States is the highest tax nation in the world. Now, there are some experts who say that's not the case. But when it comes to lowering corporate tax rates, that's certainly something that Republicans in Congress will be very quickly on board for.
CBS News correspondent Stephen Portnoy covering Congress. Oh, what a year. Happy holidays, Stephen.
Happy New Year, Dan.
Tremendously famous, significant people died this past year. With our brief obituaries, CBS's Jim Chenevay.
Viva la revolución!
Fidel Castro is being remembered as both a freedom fighter and a dictator. Antonin Scalia, Nancy Reagan, and Shimon Peres were saluted for their public service. CBS mourns Morley Safer.
I like doing stories that no one else is doing.
Harper Lee only published two books, but one of them was a classic.
All I want to be is a Jane Austen of South Alabama.
When it came to boxing,
I must be the greatest!
Muhammad Ali left us, as did hockey's Gordie Howe and golfer Arnold Palmer.
Yeah! Oh, God in heaven, what have I done?
What you did, Gene Wilder, was make fans laugh. Final hallelujah to music greats Leonard Cohen, Prince, David Bowie.
Lift off.
And Godspeed to space pioneer John Glenn. Jim Chenevay, CBS News.
We have a lot more coming up, including Zika virus, one of the big stories of 2016. Also, the Olympics in Brazil on the CBS News year-end roundup.
The CBS News weekend roundup after this short break.
Don't have time to keep up with the news? Try the CBS Radio News app on your iOS or Android device. You'll get the latest news as soon as you start it up. It's that easy. You can also listen to great programming like Face the Nation, the CBS Evening News, and the Weekend Roundup when you want it. You can even download them straight to your phone and listen later. It's all on the CBS Radio News app for iOS or Android. Download it today.
On the CBS News year-end roundup for 2016, I'm Dan Revive. Spread by mosquitoes, the Zika virus was blamed for thousands of birth defects, babies born with small heads and small brains. And in Brazil, six deaths were officially reported. In Puerto Rico, at least five deaths. People in South Florida were concerned as Zika-carrying mosquitoes were detected. Most people who got the virus hardly knew they had it. The scare isn't over. More from CBS's Barry Bagnato.
2016's biggest health scare threatened babies and millions of mothers and women wanting to be.
Women are scared to death right now.
From South America mainly, the Zika virus spread to the U.S. through travel, but then locally generated cases emerged in South Florida, triggering aerial spraying, a run on insecticides.
Deet should be Miami's new perfume.
And painstaking searches.
Finding an infected mosquito is like looking for a needle in a haystack.
CDC Director Dr. Tom Frieden chafed as Congress took months to approve more than $1 billion for the fight.
The only winner from not having money for Zika is the Zika virus.
Zika's the only known mosquito-borne virus that can be transmitted sexually. A single bug bite can infect people with both it and chikungunya virus, which causes similar symptoms. There's still no Zika vaccine, but progress is being made. Until one's available, CBS's Dr. John LaPook says.
Cover up by wearing long sleeves, long pants. Make sure screens are repaired. And freestanding water. Get rid of that.
Barry Bagnato, CBS News.
Now to correspondent Steve Futterman, who had one of our plum assignments. He was at the Summer Olympic Games in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil.
The Rio Olympics began with many concerns, including security and the Zika virus. But once the spectacular opening ceremony took place, the attention quickly shifted to the competition.
Michael Phelps wins his 20th gold!
There were plenty of familiar names. Swimmer Michael Phelps won 5 gold medals, eventually increasing his career gold medal record to 23. At the track and field stadium, Jamaica's Usain Bolt won his 9th career gold medal.
Usain Bolt does it! The triple triple!
There were some newcomers. American Simone Biles became the 3rd woman gymnast ever to win 4 golds at a single Olympics. For the host country, Brazil, its top moment,
Brazil is Olympic champion,
came when it won the gold in men's soccer. Away from the competition, U.S. swimmer Ryan Lochte made up a story about being held up at a Rio gas station. He and 3 other American swimmers were sent home. Lochte received a 10-month suspension. Steve Futterman, CBS News.
Let's consider how America's towns and cities get along with their police forces. There's been a lot of tension. A lot of it appears to be racial in recent years. But was it any better in 2016? We turn to CBS News Homeland Security correspondent Jeff Pagés. What's your impression? Was 2016 absolutely terrible or in a way no worse than 2015?
Well, listen, the dialogue has begun. And I think that began in early 2016. There was the president's task force on 21st century policing. And so there have been a lot of police departments across the country that are putting in reforms. They're talking about body cams, and they're talking about training of officers, regular training of officers. And something that I've learned, there are a lot of people in the community who feel that there cannot be trust between a police department and the community it's serving without accountability. Because what we've found is that in a lot of these cities where there has been this strain in the relationship between police and the community, there was, in the eyes of the community, a lack of accountability when it came to the police officers and how they were doing their jobs. They were breaking with protocol, and the protocol wasn't being enforced. And so there has been reform. The dialogue started in early 2016, and it is continuing in a lot of cities where police chiefs realize that there is a problem, and they're trying to help solve the issues.
Well, when you spoke with police in a lot of America's cities, did they feel they were being unfairly picked on?
Well, certainly. A lot of police chiefs, and certainly the rank and file, feel that there are some politicians who are anti-police, that they are being unfairly targeted. But there are a lot of police chiefs who understand the criticism and are trying to reach out to the community. They're trying to enact policies that have more community dialogue, more community involvement. They have to build these bridges to the communities.
Jeff Pagés, I know you've been working on a book on this very subject or this set of subjects, and you mentioned the big cities. And I think of Chicago in particular and its murder epidemic. Is there any sign things are getting better? And is it simply a failure by police? I understand that the rate at which they solve the crimes and arrest the murderers is really low.
Well, there are some major problems there. And I think everyone who lives there now understands that what is happening shouldn't be happening there. We have homicide rates that are 50% higher than what they were in 2015. And so they realize they are grappling with some really serious problems. The mayor of that city has announced some reforms, but there is still this rift in many communities in Chicago between police and the communities that they serve.
Yet the people in the communities, knowing that their own sons and daughters have been murdered, sometimes at playgrounds, who else can they turn to if not the police?
Well, they have to turn to police. And so there is this relationship that has to happen between police and the communities they serve. But in Chicago, you have a history there, and that history is still getting in the way of the future, in that you had Laquan McDonald, for example, shot 16 times by an officer who will be going on trial. The people in those communities, they haven't forgotten about that.
Who are the criminals? Are we talking about drug gangs? Are we talking about Chicagoans?
Well, Chicago has a real problem with gang activity as well. According to some of the statistics that I've seen, there are 600 different gangs.
Would you tell me, frankly, whether Donald Trump's victory has some impact on where things are going? I mean, I realize he's not yet president. People may not know what kind of president he'll be. But in most of these disputes as a candidate, he seemed to take the side of the police.
Well, you're right. He talked about bringing back law and order. He talked about stop and frisk. And depending on who you talk to, those things mean very different things. And it's a highly emotional issue. Certainly stop and frisk is one of the tactics that has led to this divide. And so to talk about bringing that back, well, that is not really a solution if you're talking to people in some of these communities where stop and frisk was used over and over and over again.
Well, police might pick on African-American youth, for instance, but have you come across, let's say, their parents, their uncles and aunts who said, they've got to do something. I mean, has there been a wish that policies will change? Barack Obama was a black president from Chicago, but he certainly didn't solve this.
Well, but he helped move the issue forward. There was this discussion. There were a lot of people in law enforcement who did not think that President Obama was on their side in this debate. So that has led to a lot of the friction. Where does an Attorney General Jeff Sessions, if he's confirmed, take this debate?
CBS News Homeland Security correspondent Jeff Pagés. Thanks, and Happy New Year, Jeff.
Thank you.
Please follow us on Twitter. We have headlines day and night at CBS Radio News. I'm at Dan Revive, and this is the CBS News Year-End Roundup. On the CBS News Year-End Roundup, I'm Dan Revive. Let's review the top headlines from outside the United States in 2016. We begin with CBS's Vicky Barker in London.
In Syria, President Assad, backed by Russian muscle, continued his savage fight to crush rebels.
And as always, civilians are doing most of the dying.
The mass exodus across the Mediterranean intensified, but thousands who began that journey didn't live to finish it.
Overcrowded and top-heavy, the wooden fishing boat packed with migrants tipped over.
Europe erected new physical and legal barriers against the refugees, in part fearing terrorist infiltrators. But ISIS took responsibility for inspiring the truck driver who murdered dozens in Nice, France. Elsewhere, Britain shocked Europe, the world, and even itself by voting for Brexit.
It may be years before Britain actually leaves the EU, but already nothing's the same.
American bombers flew over South Korea, a warning to Pyongyang to stop testing nuclear arms. And back home,
regular commercial flights from the U.S. to Cuba resumed.
But the future of Cuban-American relations remains unclear, with President-elect Trump threatening to reverse some of the policies and pacts of the Obama White House. Vicky Barker, CBS News.
Late in the year, a rift between the U.S. and Israel. 2 days before Christmas, a diplomatic controversy erupted when the United States did not protect Israel from a United Nations Security Council resolution blasting Jewish settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem as illegal. The U.S. did not veto the resolution. President Obama decided to abstain. A strong message of disapproval to Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who responded by accusing the Obama administration of siding with Israel's enemies. Netanyahu said he looks forward to a better relationship with Donald Trump. Also in the Middle East, the civil war in Syria. In 6 years, an estimated 500,000 deaths, millions of wounded and refugees. Also a civil war in Yemen, seen as a battle between Sunni Muslims backed by Saudi Arabia and Shiites supported by Iran. There are terrorists in Egypt, Sinai Peninsula, recent terrorism in Jordan. CBS News correspondent Robert Berger in Jerusalem. Let's begin with Israelis and Palestinians. No direct peace talks between them. Why do Israeli politicians who blame the Palestinians expect Mr. Trump to be better for Israel? What do they see?
I think they see someone who they believe will keep his word and who might do things that aren't politically correct, such as moving the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Mr. Trump said he would do that during the election campaign, and now he's appointed a man named David Friedman, a pro-Israel hawk, to the post of U.S. ambassador. And in accepting the job, Friedman said he looks forward to working from the U.S. embassy in Israel's eternal capital, Jerusalem. Those kind of comments play well among Israeli politicians.
There's extra pressure, Robert, just to the northeast of Israel and the Palestinians, the civil war in Syria. What are some of the elements there that we should keep in mind? The U.S. got involved in order to bomb ISIS in both Syria and Iraq. Who are the other players?
Well, the biggest fundamental change was the intervention of Russia, which effectively turned the tide of the war in favor of Syrian President Bashar Assad. Assad has also been helped by two of Israel's arch enemies, Iran and its Shiite ally Hezbollah in Lebanon.
What about the nuclear deal with Iran? Of course, the U.S. and other countries dropped most of their sanctions, so Iran is suddenly flush with cash, buying airplanes and who knows what else. Robert, what's Israel saying, and what about the Arab countries?
Well, Israel's always opposed the deal, and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu even bypassed the White House and went directly to Congress to try to stop it. He simply doesn't like the fact that most of Iran's nuclear infrastructure remains intact. And now Netanyahu is saying that he hopes to work with President-elect Trump to try to roll the deal back. With regard to the Arabs, the Sunni Muslim Gulf states led by Saudi Arabia also don't like the deal. They feel just as threatened by Iran as Israel does.
In Jerusalem, that's CBS News correspondent Robert Berger, wishing you a happy and safe New Year.
Thanks, Dan, and same to you.
Let's follow up with CBS News correspondent Holly Williams. You're reporting from Turkey, a mostly Muslim country that's partly in Europe, partly in Central Asia. So it's part of the West and the Middle East, affected by the violence just to the south in Syria. Holly, what's Turkey doing inside that war-torn Arab country?
Well, this is another complicated question when it comes to Syria. This year, for the first time since the Syrian conflict began, we saw Turkey intervene directly in Syria. Turkish special forces, Turkish tanks rolling across the border, Turkish airstrikes and artillery. Ostensibly, what Turkey was doing was clearing ISIS from the last stretch of border between Turkey and Syria that ISIS still controlled. And Turkey has now cleared ISIS from that area. But Turkey had a second reason for going into Syria, and it involves those Kurdish groups that operate in northeastern Syria. The Kurds are an ethnic minority. They live in Iran, Iraq, Turkey, and Syria. They don't have their own state. And here in Turkey, Kurdish militants have been fighting against the Turkish state for decades. The Kurdish groups that are backed by the U.S. inside Syria that are fighting against ISIS are linked with the Kurdish groups in Turkey that are fighting against the Turkish government. And remember, Turkey is a NATO ally of the US. So once again, this is really complicated. Turkey has gone into Syria to fight against Kurdish groups that are being backed by the U.S.
Very complex. And Turkey has paid a cost. There have been some horrible terrorist attacks, not just the assassination of the Russian ambassador a few days before Christmas, but bombings where you are in Istanbul, sometimes blamed on ISIS, sometimes on Kurds. And then there's the extra pressure. Tell us a little bit about the coup attempt this past July when President Erdogan was almost overthrown.
The coup attempt here was surprising for a lot of people because the conventional wisdom was that even though over the last few decades we've seen the Turkish military intervene and carry out coups, most people felt that the power of the military had been curbed by Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the Turkish president. He's been the most powerful man in this country for around 13 years now. But suddenly, one night in July, members of Turkey's military staged an attempted coup. We had tanks on the street. We had the Turkish parliament building being bombed. Now, the coup wasn't successful. And since then, we've seen the Turkish government purge thousands of people from the military, from the police force, from the education department, school teachers. Anyone that the Turkish government believes is associated with a group of people known as Gulenists. They are followers of an Islamic preacher named Fethullah Gulen, who happens to live in Pennsylvania in the U.S. And Fethullah Gulen has really become enemy number one here in Turkey.
And just adding to the complexity, the Turks want the United States to extradite him. CBS News correspondent Holly Williams in Istanbul.
Thank you.
Still to come in this special broadcast marking the end of 2016, tech breakthroughs and controversies. Stay tuned, please, to the CBS News Year-End Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Download the CBS Radio News app, either on iOS or Android. You also get great features, breaking news, and access to the CBS Radio News Twitter and Facebook feeds. Learn about your world while you take care of all the things you need to take care of. It's perfect for the gym, running errands, or doing chores around the house. CBS Radio News. Get it in the Apple App Store or Google Play today.
On the CBS News Year-End Roundup, I'm Dan Raviv. At the beginning of this special broadcast, we said without doubt the top story of the year was the election of Donald Trump. Let's look at that a different way with CBS News technology analyst Larry Magid. Think about how Mr. Trump was communicating with voters using social networking, above all Twitter. That was very different, Larry, from previous national political campaigns.
It was. Now, of course, he's not the first presidential candidate to have used social media, Twitter and Facebook, but to use it directly all by himself in one famous case at 3 a.m, I think that was extraordinary. And even though he got a lot of flack for it, it obviously did him a lot of good as well, because it gave him a direct relationship with his supporters and probably helped get the enthusiasm gap working in his favor because of his direct relationship.
But Larry, without doubt, on occasion, Mr. Trump was tweeting out stories that weren't really true, kind of rumors, something that would help him. I guess that now goes into the category of what we call fake news.
There was a lot of fake news during this election, and I have to say, much of it came from the conservative side, although not exclusively. And it turns out that there was not only a political motivation, but there was also an economic motive as well, because some of these fake stories were being posted overseas by people who all they wanted was to get people to click on their websites, go to their sites, look at ads, click on ads, and they made money. In fact, one person famously admitted that he was a Clinton supporter, yet kept posting anti-Clinton fake news because it brought him a lot of eyeballs and a lot of money. At the same time, there are those who claim, rightly or wrongly, that it might have influenced the election, because a lot of people were making decisions not based on their opinion about real facts, but about fake facts.
Well, one wonders this past year, I suppose. Now, this is serious, because certainly there are Democrats who feel that a major element in Hillary Clinton's defeat was hacking, which is being blamed on Russians. The Democratic National Committee was hacked into just around the time of the party convention. And then John Podesta, the chairman of Clinton's campaign, his Gmail was opened and extracted and filtered, and anything that was embarrassing was leaked, usually through WikiLeaks. What should we make of that?
Well, deciding whether or not that actually influenced the election is probably above my pay grade. But what I will say is that it shows the importance of email and how one getting into one's email can reveal a great deal, not only about the person being hacked, but about all their friends and associates.
IoT, that's the Internet of Things, you know, not just my computer or iPhone. There was evidence this past year that the Internet of Things is not secure.
That's right. There was a botnet that was actually aimed against devices, and many of these devices, some of which are being cranked out at a record number by startup companies that may be thinking about cool ideas but not great security, were able to harbor and then, in a sense, retransmit some of these malicious codes, which had a huge impact, actually shutting down some major websites. So we now know that the Internet of Things is vulnerable, not only in terms of being attacked directly, being part of a botnet that can attack other sites and other devices.
The Samsung Galaxy Note 7 sometimes burst into flames due to a battery defect.
One thing to be hot in the market, another thing to literally overheat. They actually caught fire, and in some cases actually exploded, causing Samsung to have to recall the phones, causing the airlines globally to have to ban them. And to this day, when you get on a plane, you're told to make sure you don't have your Galaxy Note 7, or if you do, turn it off.
Or turn it into the airline crew, who have a special protective bag for that supposedly explosive device.
It became a huge issue for Samsung, so much so that they eventually had to simply discontinue the phone. They tried to come out with a safer version, and even that was accused of catching on fire. A big black eye for the big Korean electronics maker.
What about Apple's decision to get rid of the headphone jack on the latest iPhones?
You know, Apple can do amazing things, and because it has huge market share and power and prestige, it's able to get away with things. And so they were able to come up with an adapter if you want to use your old headphones, or you can get their headphones, or even these wireless AirPods, as they're called. But I do think eventually they'll find other ways to get that sound from the phone into your ears.
including Bluetooth, which some people can figure out. I'm not so sure I can. Hey, before I leave you, look around you. I know you're often in Northern California. Is there a decent chance there's a self-driving car somewhere around you?
In my neighborhood, they're all over the place because I live just a mile from the Googleplex in Mountain View. So everywhere I go, I see these little cars driving around. There's a driver in them, but they're mostly just sitting there because the car is actually doing the driving. Also, Uber has put self-driving cars on the road in San Francisco and Pittsburgh, and they've gotten some backlash in San Francisco. One of them ran a red light. Uber claims there was actually a driver in charge, not software.
So Uber suspended that program in San Francisco, but...
They're coming. There will be one on a street near you someday, and maybe there'll be one in my driveway someday.
And Larry, to be clear, they're not just for convenience. The thought is that if just about everybody had a self-driving car, then there'd be fewer traffic jams because all the cars would move so efficiently.
There'd be fewer jams. There would also probably be fewer accidents because self-driving cars don't consume alcohol. They don't get tired. They don't get road rage. They don't have bad judgment. So eventually, I think it's going to contribute to much safer transportation. But that's going to take a long time before it happens, and it ultimately won't happen until most or all of the cars on the road are self-driving, and then they'll be talking to each other and making sure they keep their distance.
CBS News technology analyst Larry Magid, thanks for helping us look ahead, and have a happy new year.
Thank you, and happy new year to you as well.
Now looking at entertainment stories this past year, CBS's Deborah Rodriguez.
2016, a year to tune into the political candidates on late-night TV.
Can I mess your hair up?
NBC's Jimmy Fallon got playful with Donald Trump. After the election, politics came to Broadway.
What time is it?
The Tony Award winners at Hamilton called out Vice President-elect Pence.
We are the diverse America who are alarmed.
There was another diversity drought, then changes promised at the Oscars.
Otherwise known as the White People's Choice Awards.
Change fast-paced in Cuba. Half a million watched the Rolling Stones in Havana. The Nobel Literature winner,
come gather around people, wherever
Bob Dylan, skipped the ceremony in Stockholm. And unexpected goodbyes. David Bowie and Prince signed off, and so did American Idol.
Good night, America.
Not only David Bowie and Prince, who was only 57, but on Christmas Day, the British singer George Michael died, age 53. And a Russian military plane crashed, killing a famous army choir. Yes, the choir that sang that at the Winter Olympics 2 years ago. The plane crash killed 92 people. The amusing celebrity Zsa Zsa Gabor died at age 99 in Los Angeles. And then a shock in L.A., Carrie Fisher, famous from the Star Wars movies, had a heart attack and died at age 60. The next day, her mother, Debbie Reynolds, the movie star and singer, died. She was 84. Time to turn the page to 2017. Please remember we're on the radio with news every hour, and you can use our app called CBS Radio News on your smartphone or tablet to find us anytime. Look for the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Produced by Steve Dorsey in Washington, please stay tuned. I'm Dan Revive. On the CBS News year-end roundup, we have a few extra minutes beyond the length of the usual weekend roundup. So let's chat with CBS News senior legal analyst Andrew Cohen, and then we'll turn to London and talk about Brexit and Europe. Andrew, there were lawsuits surrounding the demand by the Green Party and its candidate for president, Jill Stein, after raising money to have the votes recounted in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. That led pretty much nowhere. The Trump victories, however slim in those three states, still stand.
That's right, Dan. We learned two things in the weeks following the election. One, that it is very hard to sustain and succeed in a recount. There are instances of it. The Florida example in 2000 went all the way to the Supreme Court, of course, before it died. In Minnesota, Al Franken has his job as a senator there because of a recount. So it happens on a state level from time to time, but it's very hard for it to happen on a presidential level. But elections are messy. Voting is messy. Even after 2000, the United States and the states that handle these elections did not invest in the kind of technology that would ensure more accurate vote counting.
Andrew Cohen, let's talk about one of the effects of Donald Trump's victory that seems definite. and that is the Supreme Court. He issued a list when he was a candidate of the various judges that he would consider for the Supreme Court, all conservatives, all similar, he said, to the late Justice Antonin Scalia, while Republicans in the Senate refused to grant any hearings to Merrick Garland, the judge who'd been chosen by Barack Obama. So forget about Judge Garland, right? We're all wondering whom Donald Trump will choose.
Right. Forget about Merrick Garland. And I think that's going to be one of the historical footnotes to the 2016 election, indeed to the whole term for Congress, that Republicans in Congress made a bet that Donald Trump would win the election. They made a bet as early as this spring when they said, no matter who the president nominates, we are not going to have a confirmation hearing to replace Justice Scalia. They held to their guns. There was some public protest, but not clearly enough. They figured they would roll the dice, hope that Trump would win so that he would be able to pick the nominee instead of Hillary Clinton. Had Hillary Clinton won the election, the Republicans would have lost that bet because she quite likely would have nominated somebody more liberal than Merrick Garland. Merrick Garland was not necessarily a liberal candidate for the court. So here we are. We're going to have a Trump presidency. He has given a list of very conservative judges who would become the next justice to replace Scalia. And the 5-4 conservative split that's been on the court for decades would reestablish itself, certainly to the benefit of conservative causes.
When we go back to 9 justices, it sure looks like it's going to be, on most cases, 5-4 with a conservative majority, right?
It'll be 5-4 with a conservative majority and a stronger one, you could argue, because you've replaced the sort of ailing Justice Scalia with presumably somebody who's quite younger. Justice Antonin Kennedy is getting up in age, of course. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. There is the possibility over the next 4 years that one or more of those justices would leave, and that would allow Donald Trump to cement into place for a generation, let's say, a conservative court. You know, one of the underreported contrasts in the election that we just had was the effect it would have on the Supreme Court. I think that's a big deal, especially with a president-elect who's talking about these significant fundamental changes in the way America is going to be governed.
CBS News senior legal analyst Andrew Cohen. Thanks and Happy New Year, Andrew.
My pleasure, Dan, and to you too.
The European Union, it has 28 member nations, if you include the United Kingdom. But the United Kingdom, sometimes we say Great Britain, decided to pull out. British voters faced a referendum on June 23rd. They faced one question, and between leave and remain, 52% voted to leave the European Union. Let's turn to CBS News senior foreign correspondent Mark Phillips. You're in London. Let's think back to June. I recall that the opinion polls indicated that that's not how voters would vote, and it was a big surprise that night, right?
It was a surprise. In the run-up to the vote, the opinion polls, which kind of coalesced around a 2-4 point victory for the Remain side, for the side that wanted to stay in the EU, the number settled about there. So it was a considerable shock and a vote that was won on a coalition that's starting to appear more and more familiar across the Western world.
Do you mean that other countries, specifically in Europe, might pull out of the EU, or even the United States and other countries have these similar coalitions?
On the European thing, we're going to have to wait. There are big votes coming up over the next year. In Germany, in France, in the Netherlands, it's a little early to predict, although the signs are there. But the greatest comparison that's being made in this past year is between the Brexit vote here, the vote for Britain to decide to leave the European Union, and the presidential election vote in the U.S., so where a disaffected, often largely white, a largely male, largely less well-educated than the other side, largely rural instead of urban, supported the more populist or least establishment option and voted for change. That's what happened here. It was a broad assembly of voters, some of whom voting on issues like sovereignty, who had control over the making of laws, people wanting it back here in Britain as distinct from in Brussels. But a lot of people also voting on the issue of immigration, basically to keep the borders or close the borders to incoming Europeans who have the right under EU law to come and work in Britain. And a lot of fear here, the usual sorts, that they're coming in to take jobs, to put pressure on education and health facilities and that kind of thing. And the assembly of those sorts of ideas was enough to push the vote over those 2% above 50% and produce a leave vote.
Those voters who voted to leave, they weren't so much focused on the advantages to Britain. They're British people working all over the continent of Europe and doing very well.
It wasn't, in the end, a rational argument. Or if it was a contest between a rational argument and an emotional argument, both here and, I would argue, in the presidential election in the U.S. as well, the emotion tended to win out.
The referendum was basically the idea of the Conservative Party Prime Minister David Cameron. So he was so humiliated, he resigned right away. Britain has a new prime minister, Theresa May. Is she pulling out of the EU very quickly or kind of trying to slow that down?
Well, nobody knows. She said in her very first words on taking over the prime ministership that Brexit means Brexit. People are still trying to figure out what that phrase means because there aren't two people in the country who know what Brexit means.
Kind of like a big state of the United States seceding, trying to do it peacefully, and we'll see if it even gets done. That's CBS News senior foreign correspondent Mark Phillips speaking from London. Thanks and Happy New Year, Mark.
Happy New Year to you too.
Our sincere wish to all of you for a healthy, happy, successful 2017. Thanks for being with us all through the year. Please do find our podcasts on your phone, tablet, or computer. Of course, we're on the radio all the time. This has been the CBS News Year-End Roundup. Best wishes from all of us at CBS. I'm Dan Revive.